Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated December 17th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. From the front page at the top of the fold, Pool giving $40 million, NCSU's largest gift ever, by James Gallagher, from Raleigh, North Carolina State University. Alumnus and longtime Raleigh business executive Lonnie C. Poole Jr. is giving $40 million to the university. It's the largest single cash gift in NCSU's history. The donation will go to NCSU's endowment and is largely intended to support the College of Management, which will be renamed the Lonnie C. Poole Jr. College of Management. Chancellor Randy Woodson said the gift will elevate our ability to have one of the most competitive business colleges in the country. College of Management Dean Ira Weiss says the gift is a major statement in the community that we are one of the forces in business education and leadership to be reckoned with. Poole, who was the first in his family to graduate from college, says he has reached a point in his life that he needs to figure out what to do with his wealth, and he wants to give back to the community, starting with NCSU. I have a long history with North Carolina State and the donation of more time than money, he says, referring to his past participation on various boards at the college. Poole says he chose to give to the College of Management because it is the newest college at the university, having been formed just 18 years ago. In that time span, the college has not produced enough alumni who can give back and develop an endowment as large as other business schools in the area, including UNC Chapel Hill's Keenan Flagler Business School and Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. I was aware of the need, especially in newer colleges, he says. The donation is the latest in a series of gifts that Poole and his wife, Carol Poole, have been doling out over the years. They gave $3 million to help with the construction of NCSU's golf course, also named after Lonnie Poole. In fact, a portion of the latest $40 million donation will go to complete the golf course project with the construction of a clubhouse to be named after Carol Poole. Poole's wealth comes from Waste Industries USA, the solid waste collection firm he started in 1970 and grew into a $400 million enterprise. Poole earlier this month retired from the company, stepping down as chairman of the board and selling his stake to private equity firm Macquarie Bank. That deal closed December 7th, exactly 40 years after Poole incorporated the company. Now he calls himself a retired philanthropist. Prior to this donation, the largest single cash gift the university ever received was $20 million from the Randall B. Terry Foundation for the College of Veterinary Medicine, says Nevin Kessler, Vice Chancellor for University Advancement. Woodson has said that one of his goals is to bolster NCSU's endowment, and this donation does that, single-handedly pushing its value up by about 10% to about $440 million. The donation comes at a critical time for NCSU. Like all state universities, the institution is facing substantial budget cuts next year due to a projected state deficit of $3.7 billion. Endowments provide continual support to universities, which generally spend a portion of their investment income on operations. Woodson says such funds will help the university retain its best faculty. The state has not approved raises for all employees for the past 3 years, but NCSU can use non-state approved dollars towards such incentives. This is just a transformational gift for us at a time when these sorts of gifts are hard to come by, says Woodson. Weiss says the College of Management's portion of money will be used to create several endowed professorships, recruit top-notch faculty in technology and innovation, hire young faculty to augment the college's research output, and invest in creating programs related to sustainability in business. We will work with our business partners and international partners to strengthen this area, sustainability, and bring this expertise into the college and create a center of excellence, he says. Poole is particularly interested in the creation of new sustainability programs at the college. In the world of business today, you have to consider the environmental impact of what you are doing in your enterprise, he says, adding that majors such as environmental engineering were unheard of when he was a student. The gift is among the few of its magnitude given to any university this year, according to records kept at the Center on Philanthropy at Indiana University. Since the first quarter of 2007, when Joan and Dennis Gillings gave $50 million to the UNC Chapel Hill School of Public Health, more than 235 donors have given gifts of $40 million or more to various universities, hospitals, institutions, and nonprofit organizations, according to the center. Only about 10 such gifts have been made to universities in 2010. Next up, State Law Aims at Travel Sites, by James Gallagher, from Raleigh. North Carolina revenue officials believe a new state law will close a loophole that they say has allowed online travel companies to escape paying millions in hotel occupancy tax dollars. Beginning January 1, provisions go into effect that will classify online travel sites such as Hotels.com, Expedia.com, Travelocity.com, Orbitz.com, and many others as retailers. As a result, the web companies will be required to collect and pay taxes to the state, cities, and counties on the margins and facilitation fees they charge when booking hotel rooms. Mark LaPorte, chief executive officer of Raleigh-based Concord Hospitality Enterprises, which owns 78 properties across the country, including North Hills Renaissance Hotel, says the tax issue must be resolved sooner than later. I believe it is an unfair practice if these online brokers are allowed to keep the taxes, LaPorte says. We, as a hospitality industry, will continue to fight this hard. At issue is the difference between what travel sites charge customers for a hotel room and what they pay the hotel for that room. Government officials contend that the sites are charging taxes based on the cost of the room to the customer, but are only paying taxes on the amount they are paying the hotel. The travel companies, it is alleged, are keeping the difference. As online travel sites become more popular with consumers and smaller hotels give out more of their inventory for sale, experts believe municipalities and state governments will lose more and more money with every passing year. It is estimated that more than $1 billion in additional tax revenue is being lost by government agencies nationwide, a big number given tens of billions in expected budget shortfalls this upcoming fiscal year. North Carolina Department of Revenue spokeswoman Beth Stevenson says the law is expected to put additional dollars into the state coffers. But just because the state is pronouncing these online travel sites as retailers does not mean these companies will start complying. Similar cases are beginning to mushroom all across the country, with judges ruling sometimes in the favor of the online companies and other times in favor of municipalities. North Carolina's changes stem from a lawsuit brought by revenue officials in Pitt County, who claim that online travel providers have been failing to fully remit occupancy tax payments on the rooms they book. A federal judge found in favor of the travel companies, saying they are not retailers and, as a result, are not subject to state tax laws, says Janice Gallagher, Pitt County attorney. Gallagher was not representing the county when the suit was filed in 2008. Revenue officials hope the new law will pass judicial muster. Government leaders contend that an online travel company that pays $50 for a hotel room might charge the customer $100. The company calculates the occupancy tax, which is 6% in much of the triangle, on the $100 for a $6 charge. But the travel site pays only $3, 6% of $50, to the hotel. Calls to several of the online travel companies were not returned. Kate Sutherland, a spokeswoman for Travelocity.com, declined to comment and referred calls to Andrew Weinstein, a spokesman for the International Interactive Travel Services Association, a trade group representing the online travel sites. Weinstein disputes the claims that the companies are withholding any tax dollars. He says the web companies are charging a fee for their services, and the only taxes collected are based on the amount the travel site pays the hotel. He says North Carolina's new tax will increase the cost of travel by adding taxes on top of service fees. At the bottom of the front page, owing $2 million plus dollars, Oaks Construction files for court protection. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Cary, a pillar in the Cary business community, Oaks Construction Company owner Max Oaks is turning to the courts to help sort out the company's mounting debts on projects stretching across the state. Oaks Construction, which Oaks founded in 1983, has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, listing more than 140 creditors, mostly construction trade subcontractors, that the company has been unable to fully reimburse over the past couple of years. The court documents do not tally Oaks' total debts, but its top 20 creditors are owed more than $2 million, and the company claims to have less than $50,000 in assets. Its largest creditor is SunTrust Banks of Atlanta, which is owed almost $646,000. Unfortunately, when it gets down to a bankruptcy, it's simple. They've run out of cash, says Lee Smither, managing director of consulting for Raleigh-based FMI Corporation, which provides management consulting and investment banking services to construction firms. Neither Oaks nor his bankruptcy attorney, Richard Sparkman, returned calls for comment. But Smither points out that a number of construction companies that grew rapidly during the boom years of the past decade are having to retool their businesses or fold. We are seeing a lot of companies choose to liquidate, Smither says. There are owners who made a bunch of money in the boom times, and they are deciding to just take their chips off the table. They aren't filing for bankruptcy. They are simply closing the doors. Oaks Construction didn't have that option, as its financial problems have been mounting for a couple of years, says one of its largest creditors, Waco Electric Company, owner Mark Pleasant of Garners. Pleasant says Oaks owed him close to $500,000 at one point, which was why he stopped doing business with the builder. We had a long relationship with them, but we cut them off last year, he says. It's been ugly. According to bankruptcy court documents, Waco was still owed more than $200,000 for work completed on Oaks construction projects across the state. A few years ago, Max Oaks began focusing his attention on the development of commercial real estate properties, especially office buildings for medical professionals, though his private equity-funded company called Oaks Development. Most of the Oaks Development projects were between 30,000 and 40,000 square feet in size. Oaks Development is a separate entity from Oaks Construction and is not involved in the Oaks Construction bankruptcy filing. Oaks Development has built and managed properties in South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, and Texas, and even in Chicago and Boston. Max Oaks' business model was to sell ownership shares in his buildings to dentists, pediatricians, and other medical professionals, and lease out the remaining space through his own company. Oaks also teamed with the owners of Access Medical Development in Raleigh to build multiple medical office buildings in North Raleigh and in Garner. The two companies also built the Marketplace at Lake Boone Office and retail complex on Lake Boone Trail in Raleigh. Oaks took over management and leasing of the Marketplace complex after Access began defaulting on its loans. Max Oaks has more than 50 incorporations under his name with the North Carolina Secretary of State. He also owns the Oaks Commercial Realty Firm, which works with clients in negotiating deals to lease or purchase space in buildings that Oaks develops and acquires across the country. And now the lead article from the front page, Bagging a Bonanza. Airlines projected to collect $3.5 billion in luggage fees in 2010. By Chris Basden from Morrisville. Passengers whine mightily about paying baggage fees, but airline executives are laughing all the way to the bank with a projected $3.5 billion in 2010 revenue, a line item that was virtually non-existent before carriers started charging for luggage. The fees don't set well with travelers at Raleigh-Durham International Airport, but airline analysts tell passengers to get used to them. Baggage fees are here to stay, says Rick Sini, the chief executive officer of airfare website FareCompare.com. It wasn't a $140 a barrel of oil temporary measure. Some flyers, including local lawyer Ralph DeLeone, feel they're not being dealt with fairly. They're making a boatload of money, says DeLeone, who flies less than he did once because of the added cost of baggage and other fees. It's okay to make a profit, but don't gouge me. Baggage fees do, indeed, in the words of DeLeon, deliver a boatload of cash to the airlines. Though the first three quarters of this year, U.S. carriers raked in nearly $2.6 billion in baggage fees and revenue, according to the U.S. Bureau of Transportation Statistics. In 2007, baggage fees were primarily for oversized or overweight items and brought in a relatively paltry $464 million for the airlines. In 2008, blaming rising oil costs and the economic downturn, carriers started implementing fees on a passenger's first checked bag. The initiative caught on quickly and has spread throughout the industry, with Southwest Airlines a notable exception in not charging a checked fee bag. Delta Airlines leads the pack so far this year with $733 million in baggage fee revenue. The carrier charges $25 for the first domestic checked bag at the counter and $35 for the second checked bag. Passengers can save a few bucks if they pay for the bag online ahead of time. American Airlines is second with $432 million in revenue. That carrier also charges $25 for the first checked bag and $35 for the second. Bags 3 through 5 cost $100. U.S. Airways, $388 million. Continental Airlines, $258 million. United Airlines, $240 million, rounded out the top five in terms of checked bag revenue. Not everyone thinks the fees are being used to gouge customers. These airlines are supposed to be making money, says industry analyst Bob Herbst, who runs AirlineFinancials.com. His research shows that carriers lost more than $10 billion in the past decade. Even in the record, in the recent record third quarter for airline profits, most carriers posted margins in the range of 5 to 7%, he says. That's not much of a profit, as Herbst. In any other business, this would be poor performance. There are ways for customers to get around paying the fees. Carriers such as American and Delta don't require their first class and business class passengers to pay them. Delta spokesman Paul Skrebic says the carrier has a program in which passengers can avoid paying for the first checked bag by signing up for an American Express card. The program has generated a very positive response from customers, he says. American Airlines spokesman Tim Smith says checked bag fees allow the airline to offer lower fares to customers. Breaking out products and services gives passengers the chance to pick and choose which ones they value enough to pay for. He says that just 25% of the airline's customers pay a checked bag fee. The rest either are exempt or opt not to check a bag. Large and medium-sized companies whose workers fly a lot can also negotiate corporate travel deals in which they don't have to pay the fees, says Bruce Clark, the chief executive officer of CAI, a local employers association. Surprisingly, one of the set fees that actually seems to be going down are reservation cancellation and change fees. Those totaled $1.8 billion in the first three quarters of 2009, but are at $1.7 billion so far in 2010. The change fees for the major legacy carriers rose from $100 to $150 a couple of years ago. Cheney, the Fair Compare CEO, thinks the fee is now so high that once travelers get hit with it once, they are much more careful so they can avoid having to pay it in the future. Inside the front cover, law would ban state holdbacks. By Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. A joint House-Senate legislative committee that recommends tax law changes is studying a bill that would stop the state from withholding taxpayer refunds to solve its cash flow problems. The 21-member Revenue Laws Committee discussed the draft bill at its meeting in early December and can take it up again in one of two meetings scheduled for early January, says committee assistant Deanne Magnum. An affirmative vote on the measure would send it to the full General Assembly, which begins work in January 26. In one form or another, anything that's needed on this will be moving forward, says Representative Pryor Gibson, a Revenue Laws Committee member and a Democrat from Wadesboro. I think everyone is reading from the same page that this shouldn't happen again. The issue of withheld tax refunds erupted into a political brouhaha in September when it was disclosed that state policy allowed the state to keep unpaid refunds for more than 3 years old. The office of Governor Beverly Perdue said it had not agreed to such a policy, and then Revenue Secretary Ken Lay disputed that assertion publicly. Perdue responded by firing Lay and replacing him with David Hoyle, a retiring state senator. Many North Carolina taxpayers in 2009 and 2010 complained of significant delays in receiving state tax refunds as state officials attempted to match outgoing dollars with diminished tax receipts. Refund delays as of May 30, 2010, involved as many as 312,000 returns, valued at $222 million, Department of Revenue officials said at the time. The bill under consideration says delays in paying refunds results in what's essentially an involuntary, interest-free loan being made by taxpayers to the state, since the state pays no interest on any withheld refunds before May 30th. Tax refunds should not be considered assets of the state, but should instead be considered funds held in trust, the bill says, adding that laws already on the books give state administrators the tools needed to avoid a deficit in an economic downturn. Not in that tool set, the bill also says, is the practice of delaying refunds, which shifts the stress of an economic downturn from the state's budget to the state's taxpayer. When revenue officials approve a refund, the bill concludes, and submits a requisition for the money to the Office of State Controller, the controller may not withhold approval of the requisition. State Senator Josh Stein, who represents Wake County and a member of the Revenue Laws Committee, says the committee has held meetings with officials from the Revenue Department and the Controller's Office to discuss the issue. The question on the table is whether the language in existing laws provides a complete description on how the state should be handling tax refunds. Meanwhile, Stein adds, a consensus has formed that withholding tax refunds is something that won't be happening in the future. That seems to be a baseline that everyone agrees on, says Stein, but we have not yet made a final decision on whether the new law will be needed. Cowell Casting Again for Legal Help with Fund by Lee Weisbecker. From Raleigh, North Carolina Treasurer Janet Cowell, who a year ago began searching for securities litigation firms to help advise the $69 billion pension system, has reopened the hunt. In a new request for qualifications posted on the department's website, Cowell says she wants to put together a pool of such firms under a three-year contract. Potential compensation is not mentioned in the document. The attorneys would advise the office, which invests billions of dollars in pension funds and into stocks, bonds, and real estate, and a range of alternative investments on such matters as when to engage in or opt out of securities, class action lawsuits, and how to proceed in shareholder derivative actions. Public pension funds across the country have been more active in entering shareholder lawsuits since the 1990s, when federal law changes gave judges the power to appoint a lead plaintiff in such suits and to give more weight to the largest shareholders. In many cases, it was the pension funds who are the largest shareholders, says Keith Brainerd, research director for the National Association of State Retirement Administrators. It's not my impression that they, class action suits involving pension funds, have become more frequent recently, however. In fact, settlements in federal class action suits, class action shareholder cases, some of which involve pension funds, were actually on the decline through the first 6 months of 2010. At 71 cases compared with 84 during the same period in 2009, according to Cornerstone Research. Data for the second half of the year won't be available until January, says Cornerstone's John Gould. Such derivative actions occur when existing shareholders bring suit against a corporation, generally with stated goals such as improving the company's governance or stopping wasteful practices. In response to a similar call for proposals in late 2009, Cowell's office by January 2010 had received responses from 45 firms, including some of the biggest, best-known legal players in the class action field nationwide. 11 of those firms, it subsequently was reported, contributed a combined $81,550 to Cowell's 2008 election campaign, according to finance records on file with the North Carolina Board of Elections. Moreover, seven of the firms on the list of 45 also contributed a total of $60,500 to the 2008 campaign coffers of North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper, who was assisting Cowell in the selection of the securities litigator. Months passed, but no selections were announced. Asked about the process in July, Cowell spokeswoman Heather Strickland replied that, "We are currently still in the process of selecting a pre-qualified list of securities litigation counsel." Strickland wasn't available for comment on why the department now has opted to put out a call for new proposals. One of the questions on the new application asked the candidate firms whether they also applied in December 2009. Cooper's office will be involved in the selection process the second time as well, according to the document. Another request for qualifications on the treasurer's website, Cowell is also seeking proposals from tax, fiduciary, and investment lawyers. Next up, Salil's Mount, Woe's Mount. Chapel Hill Sheridan could have a new owner. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Chapel Hill. The partners of the Salil Group, already smarting from the failure of a high-rise residential office hotel tower at Raleigh's Crabtree Valley, may have to give up controlling ownership of their prized Sheridan Hotel in Chapel Hill. A deal to sell or transfer ownership of the Chapel Hill property at the corner of Fordham Boulevard and Europa Drive is in the works, but there's been no word yet on who the potential buyer is. Salil Group partners Sanjay Mundra and Dickie Walia have owned the Sheridan Chapel Hill through their Europa Partners LLC entity since 2005. In 2008, they made major investments in the property to lure National Football League Hall of Fame coach Don Shula's namesake restaurant, Shula's 347 Grill, to take space in the hotel. In 2009, they finished a major renovation of the rooms and meeting spaces. Europa Partners LLC negotiated a $12 million loan with Paragon Commercial Bank of Raleigh in January 2008 to refinance the hotel property through January 2013, according to Orange County deed records. Paragon also advanced Europa Partners $250,000 in June 2009 to help finance the renovations at the hotel. The smaller second loan payment was due on December 10th. Bob Hatley, Chief Executive Officer of Paragon Commercial Bank, says that in recent weeks, the bank has been hammering out a workout plan with the Sheridan Chapel Hill owners. "We've had a bunch of conversations. We're getting close to a resolution. But I can tell you that there is no planned foreclosure," says Hatley. "We should have had an agreement in place by the beginning of next year." Walia and Mundra declined to comment about the pending ownership change of the Chapel Hill Hotel, which has a tax value of about $10 million, according to Orange County records. Hatley would not elaborate on the bank's conversations other than to say that the Europa property offers a lot of promise and is an important part of the hospitality sector in Chapel Hill. The Chapel Hill Carborough Chamber of Commerce, for example, will host its annual meeting at the Sheridan in January, says Aaron Nelson, president and chief executive of the chamber. "Under their new leadership, they have become much more active in the community," Nelson says. "The staff has done a great job of reaching out." The Sheridan Chapel Hill is one of the larger hotel properties in Orange County, with 168 guest rooms and 17,000 square feet of meeting space, including the Shula's 347 Grill restaurant. Since the recession took hold, the Salil Group partners have been struggling to make ends meet at many of their properties. They had to abandon plans to build the ambitious $170 million, 43-story Salil Center project that was to feature luxury condominiums and a Westin hotel in Raleigh when investors began fleeing real estate deals in 2008. A Wake County judge ruled in September that the Salil partners must pay $918,320 to the Hunter Roberts Construction Group for work performed at the Salil Center site. Salil's group Skysail Condominiums project in New Bern also filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in 2009 and has begun selling units again. Next up, patents tell the story. R&D remains alive here in the United States. By Frank Van Leeuwen. From Raleigh. Research and development activity in the Triangle and the rest of North Carolina is on the upswing, as evidenced by a surge in patent activity in the last year, following a drop-off in 2009. A total of 2,810 patents were issued to North Carolina residents in fiscal 2010, a 23% increase compared to 2009, according to figures recently released by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. Companies are also filing for more patents as corporate applications in the United States rose to an all-time high of 509,367 in fiscal 2010, compared to 486,499 in fiscal 2009. Quite frankly, companies can't afford to not protect the lifeblood of their companies, which is the intellectual property, says Chris Humphrey, a patents attorney with Womble, Carlyle, and Raleigh. Patent filings increased each year from 2006 through 2008 before the recession set in. The patent figures for fiscal 2010, which ended on September 30, are preliminary and won't be finalized until early 2011. USPTO spokeswoman Kinsey Snowden says a breakout of North Carolina-specific numbers listing the top organizations awarded patents won't be available until February. That list will surely include IBM, which figures to be at the top of the heap in North Carolina and the United States. In 2009, Big Blue generated a total of 4,914 patents, marking the 17th consecutive year that IBM has led companies in receiving U.S. patents. Spokesman Mark Guan says IBM's North Carolina operations accounted for more than 600 of the company's patents in 2009. He says IBM won't have 2010 patent figures until late January. Other North Carolina patent filers include Cree, Cisco Systems, and Duke University. Patent applications declined in 2009 in North Carolina and in the rest of the United States due to a contraction in legal spending. Bentley Olive, a patent attorney with Olive Law Group in Cary, says that from his perspective, companies have generally cut back on patent filings due to the economic slowdown. He notes that the increase in patents granted in 2009 and 2010 comes from patent applications filed several years ago, before the onset of the recession. Humphrey says intellectual property has typically been regarded as recession-proof. Even if one industry slows down, others remain resilient. He points to patent filings in the late 1990s through the early 2000s, which remained steady even through the recession. He says patent filings were stable because the economic impact of that recession focused on the technology and telecommunications industry. The recent recession hit broadly across all industries. In the life sciences industry, it led to steep cuts in R&D spending. According to an Ernst & Young Global Biotechnology report released earlier this year, R&D spending plunged by 26% in 2009. Humphrey says those cuts in R&D could signal another drop-off in patent applications in the next 2 to 3 years. We'll just have to wait and see, he says. Wait for a software firm on money trail for MedApp. Mobile application work shifting to business uses. By Frank Van Leeuwen. From Wake Forest, EchoBase, a company that develops healthcare software for mobile devices, is aiming to raise $2 million in a first round of equity fundraising, according to securities documents. The funding effort comes 7 months after the company announced a partnership with French company Dassault Systèmes to pair Dassault's technology with EchoBase's mobile application that allows doctors to view medical records on Apple iPhones. Wake Forest-based EchoBase has raised $99,983, according to the filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. CEO Brent Miller did not return calls seeking comment. Besides Miller, the only names listed on the filing are those of other executives of the firm. The date of the first sale of securities was November 3rd. EchoBase has developed a software application it calls Resonate. The application gives doctors secure access to patient records, schedules, and other medical files via their iPhones. Dassault, a public company that reported more than $1.6 billion in 2009 sales, contributed to EchoBase's software by offering EchoBase use of its Innovia platform. Financial terms of the arrangement were not disclosed. Inovia is used by the U.S. Department of Defense for managing data, including classified information. At the time the partnership was announced, Michael Tellier, CEO of Inovia, Dassault Systèmes, and Inovia's capability to securely manage data from disparate sources fits with the need for managing healthcare information. After the announcement of the partnership, Echobase said it would develop an offering for Apple's iPad. Rob Terrell, founder of TouchCentric, a Raleigh company that develops software for mobile devices, says the balance of application development is starting to tilt in favor of business uses. Less than half of the apps TouchCentric has built or proposed in 2010 were consumer apps. The rest were apps specific to a business customer's needs, including healthcare-related applications. He adds that for the first time, clients have signed up for Apple's Enterprise Developer Program. This program is for applications that will be used internally within a business and won't be available on Apple's online app store. Terrell says he is aware that Echobase is working on an app targeting doctors. He says a number of companies, including TouchCentric, are developing medical applications either for doctors or for consumers. Next up, with Sedgefield, McConnell gets course with PGA Tour stop. By Justin Catanzaro from Greensboro. Raleigh software entrepreneur turned golf baron John McConnell has added another high-profile golf course to his growing collection at McConnell Golf. The stately Sedgefield Country Club in Greensboro, owned by its members since its founding in 1926 and home to the PGA Tour's Wyndham Championship, will come under McConnell's ownership once the paperwork is done within a couple of weeks. McConnell started his golf company in 2003 with the acquisition of the then-failing Raleigh Country Club. McConnell Golf now owns five other clubs, including Treyburn Golf Club in Durham, the Old North State Club in New London, and Cardinal Golf and Country Club in Greensboro. McConnell owns two other clubs in South Carolina, Musgrove Mill in Clinton, and the Reserve Golf Club in St. Pauli's Island. The 255 full dues-paying members at the Sedgefield voted on the sale of the club on December 15th. McConnell, who has been negotiating to buy the 84-year-old club for a year and who nearly withdrew his offer during the summer, believes the closing could come in early January. On December 15th, more than 70% of Sedgefield's voting members approved the change of control. The membership vote was overwhelming, and that is pretty impressive, McConnell says, adding it adds great opportunity for McConnell Golf to work with the members to make the course better. We will have a tremendous facility when we are done with all the updates, he says. The sale has been an emotionally charged issue at Sedgefield, especially for many older members who opposed it. But advocates, including the board leadership, have argued that it could be the last best chance to keep the club not only vital, but solvent. Golf courses in general, and upscale private country clubs in particular, have taken a beating in recent years, even preceding the recession, which has made matters worse. Young people aren't taking up golf in numbers similar to a decade ago. More golfers favor less expensive public clubs, and the cost of maintaining private clubs continues to escalate. At Sedgefield, where there are about 475 members, only about half pay full dues for golf privileges, an estimated debt of more than $2 million hangs over the head of the members. They must pony up at the end of each year to cover the deficit, while some $3 million were spent in recent years to restore the revered Donald Ross design course to lure the Wyndham. Many much-needed clubhouse and grounds upgrades have been deferred to save money. The country club has a tax value of about $12 million, but it's unlikely McConnell offered that much. Essentially, the company's strategy has been to target reputable but struggling clubs, offer to take the debt off the hands of the members, and then invest heavily to improve the course, grounds, and clubhouse. Dues for members might rise slightly, but annual deficits are no longer their problem. Cost savings are realized by centralizing certain management, accounting, and purchasing activities. While Wyndham officials would not comment on the purchase, they have made it clear to Sedgefield members that they supported it. Millions of dollars in promised upgrades could only enhance the annual PGA Tour stop in August. McConnell built his fortune with the sale of Triangle-based software companies Medic Computer Systems and A4 Health Systems for a combined $1.2 billion. Next up, North Carolina Department of Transportation wants to sell $300 million in bonds for highway work. By Chris Basden. From Raleigh. At a time when it's struggling to find enough revenue to meet its needs, the North Carolina Department of Transportation wants to take on about $300 million in additional debt in 2011 that would provide a funding boost to road building. The Grant Anticipation Revenue Vehicles, or GARVE bonds, as they're more commonly known, are 12-year bonds issued by the state, but they're backed by projected future federal revenue, giving them a AA rating. NCDOT Chief Financial Officer Mark Forster expects the issuance will be sometime in the first half of 2011. Forster says that the timing is good because interest rates are low and because construction costs have declined in the years since the recession hit. That's because a dearth of private sector work has helped lead to much more public sector competition. This would be the state's third issuance of GARVE bonds following the previous issuances in 2007 and 2009. The legislature has put a total cap of about $950 million on GARVE issuances. So far, NCDOT has issued about $500 million in the bonds. The Triangle has received more than $75 million in GARVE money from previous issuances. Those funds have been used for projects ranging from the right-of-way acquisition for the Rollsville Bypass to adding lanes to Wade Avenue to milling and resurfacing work on I-40, I-85 in Orange County. NCDOT officials say they aren't yet sure which projects the next round of GARVE money would be used to fund. Ed Johnson, who helms the Capital Area Metropolitan Planning Organization, has plenty of suggestions for them, including the addition of lanes on I-40 from US 1 to Lake Wheeler Road, the addition of interchanges on Capitol Boulevard from I-540 to the Neuse River, and the addition of lanes on the I-440 Beltline from Wade Avenue to I-40. Those projects are slated to receive funding down the line, but Johnson says with GARVE funding, it could be an opportunity to accelerate them. Wake County Commissioner Joe Bryan says that a data-driven process, not politics, should be used to determine how the GARVE money is spent. NCDOT has been implementing a data-driven project selection process as part of a reform movement begun by Secretary Gene Conte a couple of years ago. Let's make sure we're putting it where the most need is, Bryan says. Charlotte-based Bank of America served as the underwriter on both of the previous issuances of GARVE bonds. The law firm of Hunton & Williams worked as a disclosure counsel, while McGuire Woods acted as the bond counsel. Foster says the North Carolina Department of State Treasurer will select the underwriters and lawyers that work on the next GARVE issuance. One issue that could affect the timeline for issuing the bonds is the debate in Congress over a new highway funding bill. The previous five-year bill, which divvied up $286 billion in transportation spending among the states, expired in September 2009. Unable to reach consensus on a new bill, Congress has since passed a series of short-term extensions. Hunton and Williams bond attorney William McBride says that some of those temporary extensions, particularly the shorter ones, have not allowed GARVE issuances. While he doesn't think that the ability to issue GARVE bonds will be taken away permanently, McBride says, we're in a situation where we don't exactly know what the long-term rules are. The cost of issuance of GARVE bonds, including fees for lawyers, investment bankers, and accountants, is typically less than 2%, McBride says. And now a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. Insurer expands sex abuse efforts. In the past 7 years, efforts spearheaded by the Redwoods Group have helped reduce the incidence of child sexual abuse involving YMCAs throughout the United States by 40%. Still, says Kevin Trapani, president and CEO of the Morrisville-based insurance provider, which focuses on YMCAs, Jewish community centers, and nonprofit resident camps, that level of reduction is not enough. What's more, he says, we cannot go much further without the community being engaged. So the company and its foundation are trying to get communities involved. In partnership with Darkness to Light, a national nonprofit based in Charleston, South Carolina, that works to empower people to prevent child sexual abuse, Redwoods earlier this year launched Shine the Light. The initiative is working with 19 YMCAs throughout the United States to raise local awareness of child sexual abuse and train key community representatives to be stewards of children. Whether you are a policeman, teacher, priest, parent, or mayor, it doesn't make any difference. You are a steward of children, Trapani says. Your responsibility is to be aware of the signs of child sexual abuse and to be able to react to it and to find a way to stop the abuse from happening. For its role in Shine the Light, including a $100,000 grant that has generated $200,000 in federal funds and another $300,000 from participating YMCAs, Redwoods in November received the Corporate Voice of Courage Award from Darkness to Light. Ann Lee, president and founder of Darkness to Light, says Trapani gets the power his executive leadership will have in not only keeping children safe from sexual abuse, but also in creating an actual shift in culture. Lee, an adult survivor of child sexual abuse, says 42 million survivors live in the United States, where 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused before age 18. Trapani says the vast majority of child sexual abuse is committed by children against children, often in locker rooms, when they are in various stages of undress, and adult counselors too often not present. Redwoods, which integrates social mission into its business model, donates about $700,000 a year to charity and requires its nearly 80 employees to volunteer 40 fully compensated hours a year, has worked with its clients to change supervisory behavior, and has virtually eliminated peer-to-peer abuse events in locker rooms and showers, Trapani says. Still, he says, roughly one-third of all incidents are perpetuated by adults, and their relationships with children typically are abetted by first seducing the parent to trust the adult predator and give him or her autonomous access to the child, and then grooming the child to be receptive to sexual advances. Trapani, who grew up and worked at YMCAs, also was working to develop a national partnership with YMCA of the USA, and possibly with Urban Ministries, a media company that has served over 40,000 African-American churches. We have to train everybody, he says, to understand the warning signs of a predator grooming the child. Next up, Landis. Plexus Capital raises $56 million to do SBIC lending. Some 90 investors pitch in during firm's second funding round, which nearly hits a target of $60 million. By Lee Weisbecker. Raleigh. In a tough year for private equity fundraising, Plexus Capital, which operates out of Raleigh and Charlotte, has pulled in $56 million from investors and will formally close out its second investment fund. The 5-year-old private equity group, which began its latest fundraiser at the close of 2009 with a target of $60 million, attracted about 90 investors, split between institutions, largely banks, and high net worth individuals. Plexus sinks growth capital into mid-market companies in the Carolinas and Mid-Atlantic. In one recent investment, it committed $3 million, plus an additional $4.5 million in promised follow-on capital to Global Value Commerce Incorporated, a Raleigh-based online retailer of new and pre-owned golf equipment. Bob Anders, a Plexus founder and partner who works in the firm's Charlotte office, declined comment. We are not allowed to comment on such things until they are completed, he says. Anders is one of 5 Plexus managers. Based in the Raleigh office are founders Kel Landis, former CEO of then-RBC Centura Bank, and 2 other former Centura executives, Michael Painter and Mike Becker. Plexus Fund 1, raised back in 2005 and 6, topped out at $27 million. The company is licensed with the U.S. Small Business Administration as a Small Business Investment Company, SBIC, which means it is permitted to sell government-backed financial paper to raise an additional $2 for every dollar it raises from private investors. The $27 million that Plexus initially attracted, for example, became $81 million, which ultimately was invested in 22 companies. As to the type of investments Plexus does, of 26 portfolio companies, 14, or 56%, were leveraged buyouts. 7, or 27%, fell in the category of acquisition financing, and the rest went for management buyouts, recapitalizations, and growth financing. The investment group is the only licensed SBIC endorsed by bankers associations in North Carolina and Virginia. That, plus the roster of former bankers in leadership positions, gives it an opening with banks looking to invest some of their assets in private equity. Moreover, Plexus often makes loans to its portfolio companies in conjunction with banks, especially piggybacking on the bank financing. The Bankers Association, like its bank members, is looking for every possible solid opportunity to promote lending, especially to small businesses, says Association President Thad Woodard. We have the greatest respect for the principals at Plexus and are proud to have participated with them at this time, which is our second endorsement of their offerings. The wrap-up of the group's successful Fund 2 offering comes during a period when money commitments to all forms of private equity generally have been lackluster at best. That began to change somewhat in late 2010 as investor interest in the field appeared to be reviving, says Jeanette Volpe of Thomson Reuters, which also supplies data for the National Venture Capital Association. Globally, during the third quarter, money committed to private equity companies hit $27 billion, up 30% compared to the same period in 2009. And now a letter to the editor. MC, NC Endowment Working for North Carolina. Thanks for the well-written article. MCNC Milking Endowment for Internet Project by Lee Westbecker and the December 3rd editions of the Triangle Business Journal. You captured how an $8 million investment from the MCNC Endowment was leveraged to secure a $138 million commitment to build and acquire 2,500 miles of middle-mile broadband infrastructure for rural North Carolina. The commitment from the MCNC Endowment helped secure $104 million through the National Telecommunications Information Administration's Broadband Technology Opportunities Program, also known as BTOP, and a $24 million investment from the Gold Leaf Foundation. This new network, called the Golden Leaf Rural Broadband Initiative, GLRBI, will result in a great enhancement to the capabilities of the North Carolina Research and Education Network, known as NCREN, which MCNC operates. NCREN serves the broadband needs of students, teachers, faculty, researchers, and administrators in all of K-20 education in North Carolina. Bandwidth demand among these users is growing annually by nearly 30%. MCNC will be able to meet the rapidly growing needs of these users at stable cost for at least the next 15 to 20 years. NCREN will begin serving the bandwidth needs of public health institutions and nonprofit hospitals throughout the state starting next year, as healthcare begins to depend more on electronic medical records and internet-enabled research for the next great cures. NCREN will serve the high-bandwidth, low-latency network needs of health practitioners and researchers throughout North Carolina. Through the GLRBI, North Carolina will see approximately $138 million of spending with the private sector to expand and build the network. This will create and/or save thousands of jobs throughout the state. This network also will serve the bandwidth needs of community anchor institutions statewide at stable cost for generations to come, as well as create infrastructure that meets the advanced needs of research, education, and healthcare. Finally, North Carolina will possess critical broadband assets in areas of the state where citizens and businesses have not had access to affordable broadband services. The GLRBI has the potential to reduce the cost of delivering broadband services to consumers and small businesses in regions of the state where affordable broadband currently isn't available. MCNC will not compete with private sector telephone and cable companies to serve these consumers and businesses. A bit more endowment history. The MCNC endowment actually started at about $30 million in the early part of the decade, not $160 million. The rest of the Kronos proceeds were invested in ENC, the building and refresh of NCREN, and as a starting fund for NC IDEA. Today, MCNC leverages the returns on the endowment to make capital investments in NCREN. Like any technology-based asset, NCREN requires a capital infusion every 5 years or so to stay current. The existence of the MCNC endowment substantially reduces the cost associated with operating NCREN that MCNC passes along to the public and private education in the state. There is a greatly reduced capital refresh fee. Even today, the benefits of the MCNC endowment brings to North Carolina continue to grow. From Joe Fredoso, President and CEO of MCNC. Journey began in high school class. Triangle Business Journal publisher says farewell after 19 years at the helm. It all must have started when I was 16 years old. For my high school anatomy and physiology class, I wrote an essay on the travels of a hamburger through the human body's digestive system. That essay awarded me a position on the school's newsletter and yearbook committees. Who knew that 27 years later I would be running a business newspaper? This 19-year journey as publisher of the Triangle Business Journal is one that has brought tremendous joy to my life. It has been my honor to be part of the Triangle's business community and to participate in its growth. I am especially thankful for all the business leaders who have supported not only me, but TBJ. Of course, there are some folks who have challenged me along the way. To me, the challenges experienced in life spawn the best opportunities that lead to success. Often people ask me what I do as publisher of TBJ. My answer and the reality are, every day I work for the employees of the Triangle Business Journal. It is my responsibility to ensure that they have what they need to perform an outstanding job in delivering news and information to the Triangle community. Those employees are some of the hardest working, most dedicated, and passionate people I have had the privilege to know. We are a team with a dynamic spirit to accomplish the best products we possibly can. Over the years, this team has been and will continue to be my North Carolina family. Side by side, all of us have experienced success, change, laughs, heartaches, and celebrations. I am blessed to have them as my employees and friends. There have been many key people in my life who have influenced me, mentored me, and coached me. There is not enough room in this column to list all of those who have. However, the wind beneath my wings has been my 91-year-old father and my late husband, David. Both of them gave me the encouragement and support I needed to take a fledgling newspaper and grow it into a nationally award-winning and respected publication. After almost 25 years with American City Business Journals, it is now time for me to take another path in life. This transition will not be easy, but life is full of choices. I only pray my future choices will take me on a path as rewarding as the experiences I have had as publisher of Triangle Business Journal. One thing is for certain. I will now have time to enjoy one of my passions, golfing. And I will combine that with some travel to tropical destinations. My life would not be complete without volunteering with nonprofit organizations that have special meaning to me. That, too, is down the road. Each day will be a journey as I take one step at a time with family and friends by my side. Now, about that essay from my anatomy and physiology course, some of you reading this may know that my first career of 18 years was that of a dental hygienist. Just think. One story about a hamburger yielded two wonderful careers. In closing, I want to thank all of the advertisers, sponsors, and subscribers that have believed in the value of Triangle Business Journal. Lastly, there are not enough words of praise that describe my employees. However, from my heart, I thank them for their dedication and hard work. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is www.trianglereadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.